Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Locus Roundtable Podcast. We are recording in person at the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts in 2013 in Orlando, Florida. Today I have with me Austin Serkin. Austin, if you could say hello.
Hello.
And Jay Lake. Jay.
Hi there, and I apologize for the voice.
And we feel very happy to have both these gentlemen with us. Today we were thinking we might talk a little bit about steampunk. Jay Lake obviously has written several steampunk and steampunk-flavored novels, and Austin is a scholar of steampunk who has presented several papers at this conference and, I believe, in some other venues. Mm-hmm. So Jay, could you tell us a little bit about the steampunk novels that you have written?
I have a trilogy called the Mainspring Trilogy from Tor, Mainspring, Escapement, and Pinion, which are generally considered to be steampunk, although, to be perfectly honest, when I wrote them, that wasn't what I was thinking. But, at least not the first one. By the time we got around to the third one, it was pretty obvious what was going on. About a clockwork Earth orbiting the sun on a brass track. And the first novel is sort of a coming-of-age adventure quest story, and the other two get much broader plots and much more into the nature of the world and away from the single-character focus. I also have another duology called The Flowers Books, Trial of Flowers, The Madness of Flowers, that I don't personally consider steampunk, but I have seen other people cite as steampunk. And in fact, I find this whole topic of what is and isn't steampunk to be fascinating to me personally. So between, depending on how you count it, between three and five novels, a single title novella from PS Publishing called The Baby Killers, which is absolutely steampunk, and then several dozen or more pieces of short fiction in all kinds of venues, either on the edges or right in the heart of steampunk.
Okay, so Austin, that does lead to, like, exactly the core of things, which is, so, you know, some things are written to be steampunk by people who know steampunk, and then some things are sort of adopted or brought into the fold. How do you view that sort of the growth of the field that way?
Well, I mean, you sort of see that in every field, really. steampunk, and Jay and I were talking about this earlier, is viewed by many, or some at least, as not really a true genre, but as more of an aesthetic or a, you know, sort of a trapping of that can be applied to a wide variety of things. So you often find a lot of kind of extraneous things coming into steampunk that may seem odd, but end up having a pretty good fit. For example, there's been, in the last couple of years, a huge influx of romance novelists writing steampunk stuff.
Mel Jean Brooks, The Iron Duke, or whatever.
Yeah, for example. I'll give a shout-out to, like, Karina Cooper and Liana Hyber, Delilah Dawson, and probably some others that'll get mad at me for not saying their names. But so not only have they gotten interested in writing steampunk, but they've started coming in and being part of the community and coming to conventions, and I think that's very interesting, because another thing that we'll probably talk about a little bit is how the literature and the movement are kind of different things in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am one of those people that argues that steampunk isn't really a genre, and I make a very specific contrast with cyberpunk, which literally had a manifesto and had a fairly deep political and cultural agenda that was self-consciously built into the fabric of the field. And steampunk, which was, the term was more or less coined as a joke, I think. I mean, I wouldn't claim to know what KW was thinking at the time, but I know KW, and I was just recently rereading Locus Letter, and I'm pretty sure he was just farting around.
Probably,
you know, steampunk's a big giant lark, but more to the point, while steampunk certainly has criticisms implicit in it, criticisms of class and race and imperialism and so on, I think most of the people working in steampunk are either not conscious of those criticisms or not choosing to engage with them.
Yeah.
They're engaging with the sense of fun that most steampunk carries. And there is a relationship between steampunk and technology, but it doesn't drive at a deep thematic level necessarily the way that a true subgenre like cyberpunk did.
I agree.
That's not a negative criticism.
No,
at all.
No.
I mean, it's just an observation. But that by the same token is one of steampunk's greatest strengths. Like Austin said, it's become a romance subgenre.
Well, and one of the things that fascinated me, so I was doing a podcast, it's up on the Locus website for anyone who wants to go see it, with Fabio Fernandez and Jacques Barcia in Brazil. And one of the things they said was that there's a thriving steampunk community in Brazil, but
absolutely,
it had
yeah.
been the fashion people. They would dress up, they went and had Victorian tea parties in Brazil, which just is an image that I just want to cherish in my brain.
Yeah, not just Brazil. I mean, there's thriving communities in Chile, Argentina, overseas in Europe and Asia, and you know, Japan has a steampunk scene now, and it's amazing.
Well, and one of the things he said is that they're only just now discovering the literature. That for them,
yeah.
steampunk had been something completely separate than fiction. And they're just now starting to get people who are reading and writing.
Well, in fact, Jacques was just asking me who my Portuguese publisher was. I said, I don't have one. I'm in like 10 or 11 languages. He's like, well, let me work on that. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've my stuff's been out in, you know, Russian, Czech, German, French, Polish, Hebrew, I don't know what all, right? But nothing in Portuguese. So that thing about steampunk and literature, though, I think is interesting because I went to World Steam Expo in Detroit last year, and there were something like 1,500 attendees, and as of almost any steampunk event you go to, 99% of them are in costume. Everybody's cosplaying, much more so you see it even at the most robust science fiction con.
Yeah.
And there were bands there, including big names like Abney Park, and there were performance art troupes there like the League of Steam, and there were reenactors, and there were this, and there were that, and I think there were four writer guests, and two of them were local self-published writers. It was me and Gail Carriger were the only writers that were there from essentially the national scene. And I thought, 1,500 people and two writers. This is not the ratio I am used to.
Yeah.
And it tells you that the health of the steampunk scene is far outside of the literary realm, that it's in the costuming, it's in the role-playing, it's in the gaming, it's in the music, it's in the art.
Oh, and I mean, it's far outside of the, you know, film, comics,
yeah.
you know, any kind of media. I mean, how many, you know, actor guests were there at World Steam Expo?
Yeah.
I mean, probably none.
Yeah. It was just, and it's infused with the maker culture. You
yeah.
know, they've intertwined with each other, and it's fascinating to watch. And as I was saying to Austin earlier today, I sort of wish, you know, some of those people would buy my books. but you know, there you go. I'm just pleased to see that it's prospering, and I think there's a big sense of fun there.
Well, I was telling somebody earlier today, I forget who it was at lunch, but you know, it's really interesting the dynamic between the. You know, the people who are the makers and costumers and whatnot, and the people who are the readers. Because the readers don't necessarily want to do costuming, and the costumers don't necessarily want to read. So you end up with this really weird, and you know, there's some overlap between the two, but you end up with this weird dynamic where the two spheres don't necessarily really interact with each other.
Do they then cross over, like, through movies and games or something? You know, do we all watch Miyazaki movies and see the neo-Victorianism?
You know, I don't know that there is really any solid crossover except for maybe, like, Victorian literature or, like, the big mainstream movies like Wild Wild West.
So I'm going to ask you a dumbass question.
Sure.
Where does the coherence come from, or is there no coherence?
That is a really good question.
Yeah.
You know, part of the problem, and you mentioned earlier that you're fascinated by the whole attempt to define steampunk.
Yes, yes.
And part of the reason that that's such a difficult thing to get at is because so many people come to steampunk for so many different reasons. And when you have, you know, a lot of times, like for cyberpunk, for example,
mm-hmm.
you had this like core thing,
mm-hmm.
and then people came out from that into, you know, different interpretations of it and whatnot. Whereas steampunk is practically the exact opposite. People are creating these interpretations, which in turn are sort of informing the center philosophy.
It's like defining rock and roll, right? I mean, you know,
yeah,
there is four bar rock and roll that we all sort of point to and say, yeah, that was rock and roll, and then after that it all goes to hell.
Yeah.
So do you have anybody running around trying to enforce purity in
oh yeah of course
there are absolutely I just got Jess Nevins has an article about this talking about prescriptivism versus descriptivism.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And
because it seems like it's almost impossible for a movement to be immune from that kind of person.
Well, any successful cultural movement has exactly this challenge, and what do you do with it? In steampunk, I think what you do is you mostly ignore it and keep moving.
That seems to be, yeah.
That's fine. You go over there and rant. We're going to go over here and have fun.
Yeah.
I mean, the weirdest thing I saw at World Steam Expo for my money, and I am not a prescriptivist at all in any part of my life,
yeah.
was Nerf Punk.
That was me, actually.
Is that you?
Me and my wife started Nerf Punk.
You are personally responsible for Nerf
Yes.
Punk?
Yes.
I saw Nerf Punk for the first time in Detroit, and I was like, really? And in case you don't know what Nerf Punk is, or the audience doesn't know what Nerf Punk is.
I've only seen pictures.
Why am I saying this? You started. You explain it. I don't even explain it.
So basically, we were sitting around one day, my wife and I, and we were complaining about how often people paint Nerf guns to be steampunk. And it's one thing to take a Nerf gun and to modify it and to make it your own and really to do interesting things to it, but it's another to just take it outside and spray paint it and have that be your steampunk
gun. Glue some gears on it.
Right, you can just glue some gears on it.
Put a burn on it. Oh, wait, sorry. Different genre.
But anyway, so we were kind of good-naturedly complaining about that, and I sort of joked. I was like, wouldn't it be funny if we made outfits to match the Nerf colors rather than making the Nerf guns match the steampunk
Day
colors.
Low Victoriana.
Yes.
So my wife's eyes got really wide and she was like, let's do it.
And there was a Nerf punk contingent roaming the halls at World Steam last year. I was like, I'd never heard of this. I'm like, really? Now that's got nothing to think I'm ever going to write after that.
Actually, T. Morris and Pip Ballantyne wrote a short story working Nerf punks into their steampunk world.
Wow.
I was very amused.
It's a very protean aesthetic.
Yeah, and that contributes to how hard it is to describe and define. You know, how in the world can you define something that can look like Nerf punk, you know?
I just finished writing a chapter for Writer's Digest. They're updating their How to Write Fantasy and Science Fiction, and they commissioned me to write the chapter on steampunk for the next edition, which will probably be in print longer than anything else I've ever written, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wound up saying in there was that there are many sufficient conditions for steampunk, but none of them are necessary. And I didn't quite phrase it that way.
Yeah.
Which is to say, there's this whole laundry list of things that we all sort of agree are steampunk, but you can remove any one of them, and it's still steampunk.
Yeah.
It's not like it's not steampunk unless it has an airship.
Right,
or whatever, right?
Well, you know, and it's not even necessarily steampunk if you take out the Victorian era. I've said in the past that there is a definite relationship between steampunk and the Victorian era, but what exactly that relationship is, I don't think anybody knows.
Well, and this is why I'm puzzled when people describe my Flowers books or China Miéville's British Street Station steampunk.
Yeah.
Right. I what we used to call them New Weird. I don't know if we're still calling them New Weird or not. I don't know if that label's still hip. But
yeah, New Weird's still a thing.
Some people consider New Weird and steampunk to be closely related.
Yeah.
I don't. I'm not convinced of that myself.
Yeah.
But I'm not. I suppose if I wanted to, I could construct an argument for it, but I don't think I believe my own argument.
Yeah.
You know? in my Flowers books, I have a city that's sort of modeled on Fantasy Ecto Paris, except that it's a... It's the former capital of a lost empire, so they're sort of sitting around wondering what to do with themselves. Mm-hmm. And they have, streetcars and streetlights and things like that. So it is a roughly late Victorian, early Edwardian technology. But that's about all that's going on that would make me think of it as steampunk. And it's not, it's not... Inasmuch as there are steampunk-type plots and characters, that isn't what's really going on at all. What's really going on is a fantasy novel set in a slightly mechanized, slightly industrialized setting, in my view. I just wrote it. What do I know?
Right. Well, it's like Neil Gaiman was saying today about the authors as explosions.
Yes.
And critics as the people who walk around the outside of the explosion saying,
killed.
Yeah. I often don't know for months or years after I've written something what it's about.
Yeah.
I mean, not in a literal sense, obviously, but in a sort of larger metaphorical sense.
Yeah. It must be fascinating for you to come to conferences like this. Do people do any of your work here? Read any papers about them?
Your stuff might be a little too new.
I don't think I'm academically significant.
Yes.
You say that, but everything is academically significant.
Well, this I appreciate, and you are talking to a guy who just sent 310 pounds of boxes to Northern Illinois State University, Lynn Thomas, for the archive. So, in theory, I might become academically significant to somebody somewhere. I've run into some critical writing on the internet about my stuff, and there's critiques that veer into academic criticism sometimes, I guess is the best way to put it, right?
Sure.
But I've never seen anybody do a full-blown exegesis on on one of my works, and that'd actually be fascinating to see that, because I'd be like, wow, that's what I was doing.
Yeah.
I feel like that way when I just read reviews sometimes. It's like, really? And then sometimes I read reviews and I wonder what book they'd read that they actually put my name on, you know?
I feel like I've been that reviewer where it's like, I know this isn't what you wrote, but this is what I read, and I'm really sorry about that.
Well, you know, the thing is, the story always belongs to the reader. It doesn't matter what I... Unless I'm going to come to your house and explain it to you.
Right.
I don't get to have an opinion on what you think of it. I mean, I can have a reaction. I'm a human being.
Right,
but I don't
right.
get to sit there and say, well, gee, Karen, that's not what that book's about. You know, right?
Yeah, and, it took me off English for years when I had an English professor who, you know, asked us that it was an E.E. Cummings poem, and she'd thrown us this with no context, no... You know, not... Frankly, we went from Keats to Cummings, and that's a crime against humanity. But then she said, okay, explain what you think this poem means. So I wrote what I thought the poem meant, and she went, you're wrong. And I was like, unless you dig him up...
How can you be wrong?
How can I be wrong?
Well, and that's the thing about, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about descriptives and prescriptives in steampunk.
Yeah.
Who gets to say you're doing it wrong, right?
Yeah.
You could say you're not doing it the way I would do it. That's a perfectly valid thing to say. But that's not the same thing as saying you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, but then we run into this sort of sticky area where really what has to happen is you have to find a middle ground. Because you have some people who want to be like the protectors of the genre or whatever. And then other people who just want to do whatever they want to do. So, for example, if you have somebody come in, you know, wearing... A Burger King costume is my... Or Burger King uniform is my sort of perennial example. They can make up a story and be like, well, my character was time-traveling from the Victorian era and came to the present and had to get a job at Burger King. You know? So you can explain anything.
Well, I'm a writer. I'm familiar with that.
Right. But, you know, at the same time, if they walk around and are like, this is my steampunk outfit, people are going to be like, well...
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm just not...
So,
but if they find 40 other steampunk Burger King enthusiasts, you know, and then they get a bunch of people to dress up in McDonald's uniforms and they go to war in the park on Sunday afternoons with nerfed out burger guns, who's to say, you know?
Then you can sell tickets.
Right. So, you know, anything can be steampunk if you... And that's sort of, again, what we were getting at earlier about steampunk not being a genre and being sort of an aesthetic or a something, in that you can apply it to anything, even, you know, Burger King uniforms or what have you. But
although I can think of a few things as unsteampunky as fast food, because fast food is all about consistency of experience, consistency
yeah.
of production, consistency
yeah,
of technology,
yeah.
and steampunk is all about individualization and customization.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
really
they're almost. I think it's a great thing you pick because they're at opposite ends of the aesthetic poles.
Yeah,
yeah. Because steampunk really is almost a rejection of that kind of mass-produced culture, isn't it?
Well, sure. There's a reason it's set in the Victorian era. That's the last era at which you, even in theory, could know everything as an individual.
Yeah,
and where an individual could have enough skills to build anything. That was some chemistry and some metallurgy. And some engineering skills, you either with your own hands or supervising, you know, skilled labor, could design and build anything you want.
And I have to admit, when I go back and read biographies of the 19th century scientists, I'm just in awe. You'll have one guy who did important, moving forward, breaking ground work in electromagnetism and biology.
Read about the Brunells. Mark Brunell. Those guys are like superheroes.
Well,
they should have their own comic books.
No, yeah, Michael Faraday is my hero. I mean, seriously. He's just like...
And you read about, like, the Great Eastern, you know, the steamship, the Great Eastern. You know, anybody to think that up is a real frickin' megalomaniac. You know,
Well, I mean, the perfect example is the Wright brothers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're bicycle mechanics.
Two guys, and the Wright sister, who got written out of history, but there was, in fact, a Wright sister, who's, I'm sad to say, at the moment, chemo brain won't break up her name. I think it might have been Lucille.
Hmm.
And which one died in the plane wreck early? Orville?
I think it was Orville, wasn't it?
Okay. Whichever one died in the plane wreck early on, the other Wright brother essentially had his sister written out of the contracts, written out of history. There really were three Wrights that built that airplane.
Wow.
But because one of them was a woman... And
wow, I love that.
Lost her bookmark in history.
Well, that's one thing that hopefully we are not missing about that era, is women being written out of history. So there's actually been a lot of discussion lately about, and this might be due to the influx of romance writers into steampunk, but there's been a lot of talk about...
And they're letting girls write it now?
Yeah, I know, right? but yeah, there's been a lot of talk about feminism and the role of women in steampunk, and steampunk is... I kind of don't want to say this, but it, in a lot of ways, is kind of sexist. You know, a lot of the...
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's based in a sexist era.
Yeah, no, I know, but, you know, everybody sort of has this... We all sort of participate in this mass illusion that we're better than that time and that we've moved on and that we're not plagued by sexism and racism anymore and whatnot. And it's just a complete lie.
And by the way, I have a bridge to sell you. Yes.
What's that?
And by the way, I have a bridge to sell you.
Right. and so so there's been a lot of attention being drawn.
Well, and just the things I actually talked about in the Writer's Digest piece, and they may or may not have me edit this out because I got a skived off a little bit on a critical tangent in there. Yeah. But... some aspects of the Victorian critique are easy to own. It's very easy to own as a modern reader or writer. You know, we aren't this kind of errant racists,
yeah.
and we aren't even this kind of errant imperialists anymore, although a lot of people around the world might disagree with me as an American saying that. Right? But most of us don't want to own the embedded sexism in society. And
yeah.
So you're absolutely right. There are some aspects of this are much easier for us to shrug off or work around than others. And that's the thing I find interesting. When I start talking about steampunk with people who are not white guys like me, and you're a white guy.
Yeah.
And you're not a white guy, but you're a white gal. But you talk to, like, Niecy Shawl or somebody like that about steampunk.
Which I have.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
She's fascinating. Yeah. You get some really different thoughts that are absolutely, absolutely fascinating. And one of the things, you know, in my Mainspring trilogy, one of the things that enters very heavily in the second and third books is a lot of Chinese technology, a lot of Chinese power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's frankly because I was born and raised in China, so I kind of got it on the brain.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was born in Taiwan and went through my grade school years there. And the idea that, you know, London might have been the center of the world, but it wasn't the only center of the world.
Sure. but yeah, so racism is a big thing we're dealing with, and it's there's a number of people in steampunk who you might know who are doing a lot of good work on it. Diana Foe. Mm-hmm. Jamie, I've just totally blanked on her last name.
Jamie Go,
thank you. And many others who are trying to bring all this to the attention of white guys like us.
That's why I talk about it in the Writer's Digest chapter, because I figure I don't want to spend the next 15 years having ignored that question in print.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how much of a backlash there is from the community when you try to talk about things like that. And it's, you know, it's not just steampunk. You know, recently It was the Hugo Awards, wasn't it? That was like 60% women or something like that.
The Nebula ballot. Which I am on. This is why I know this. Somebody referred to me as the token white guy, the Nebula ballot, and I looked at the category I'm in, and there are three white guys in my category out of six. So, you know, we are, what are we, 20% white guys or 20% of the population or something? We're 50% on that piece of the ballot. But the fact that we're not the present overwhelming numbers bothers some people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, for anybody out there listening who doesn't know, there was this big kerfuffle about how it was like 60% women, and all of these, you know, basement-dwelling guys, I guess, crawled out of their basements to complain.
Because we all know how endangered white men are.
Yeah, to complain that, you know, we were losing fiction to the women and the minorities and who knows what. And it was pretty much the most embarrassing thing that's happened.
Speaking
in our
as a white guy, I'm sorry.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, that one, I started reading that comment thread, and my jaw just dropped. I was like, really?
It almost made me not vote for myself.
Yeah.
Not quite, though.
Well, so yeah, I mean, it's a pervasive thing, and it's not just in steampunk,
but to be fair, it's not just in this community. I mean, when it was pointed out to the atheist community, who are supposed to be completely rational individuals,
yeah, right,
that perhaps some of their individuals were not, particularly gender equality oriented.
There's a reason I refer to myself as a low church atheist.
Yeah, they went through the freaking roof.
Yeah.
It was a shambles and a disgrace on anybody who ever considered themselves or even thought the word atheism for the last 20 years. It was awful.
And then, you know, but what do you do when something like that happens? You know, it just becomes this big elephant in the room, and... You know, you want people to go on having fun and enjoying themselves, but at the same time, you know, you want to be responsible about these things, you know?
Well, it seems like there's some education that's starting to filter out through all this. It seems like people are starting to be more aware of the issue.
And yet at the same time, you look at, if you talk to people who spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, social justice or race issues or something, you know, or feminism and so on, they'll talk very disparagingly and with great fatigue about doing 101.
Yeah.
And doing 101, and, oh my God, do we have to do 101 again? And the answer is, well, yeah, kind of you do, you know, because people are not born knowing better. and the great thing about steampunk, to bring us back to the topic a little bit, as I think of it, it's like a big box of Legos, you know, and anybody can pick it up.
You throw it on the floor.
Yeah, anybody can pick it up and snap it together and run around going, zoom, zoom, I'm an airship, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And speaking as a writer now, one of the things I love in fiction, both as a writer and a reader, is just stylistic flourishes. I love Baroque shit. And there ain't much that's more Baroque than a good solid run of steampunk.
Yeah.
And that I won't say that makes up for the sins and deficiencies of various people who should know better, but I will say that it gives us a lot of room to play, even when we're being grumpy at each other.
It does. I agree. I mean, steampunk is such a broad sort of setting. I mean, you have, you know, your traditional, quote-unquote traditional, sort of like Victorian-era steampunk, but then you've got, like, weird post-apocalyptic stuff and, like, weird stuff that takes place in fantasy worlds and... You know, it's there's no need to interact with real world Victorian politics or race or gender issues
unless you really want to
avoid that sort of thing.
Do it if you want to.
But you know, of course, it's probably good to encourage people to do that when they can.
Well, and the point I make in the piece I just got finished drafting is, be aware of this stuff.
Yeah.
It's not up to you to solve the world's problems. But understand that other people are going to watch, going to see through this lens, and just be aware. Now, awareness may mean nothing more than, yeah, okay, but that's not what I'm doing, and getting on with your story.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, if it ain't fun, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, basically, my philosophy on such things is you should at least learn about race and gender issues, if for no other reason than so that you don't offend anyone by accident. And if you offend anyone, make sure it is on purpose.
Right.
So, that's how I feel on the subject, at least.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of people out there who are happy to offend people on purpose.
Unfortunately. Some people seem to make it their purpose in life, honestly.
Yeah. you...
Go ahead.
So you working on anything at the moment, Jay?
Yeah, but it's not steampunk. I'm working on a story about an animatronic Captain Hook who's...
Wait, you just said that this is not steampunk.
Okay, it's kind of... the backstory of the story is that in the mid-21st century, aliens invade the Earth and destroy it. And they make off with a few thousand people, more or less by mistake, on the way. And the few thousand people they make off with are happen to be the visitors to a certain theme park. And it's several hundred years later, and the only survivor of the original raid is the animatronic Captain Hook, who happened to be carried off with all the people. So the entire surviving human race has been educated for the knowledge base of someone who's A, a theme park character, and B, knows the Peter Pan backstory. And that's all they know about the human experience. And so, you know, they're a little strange. And the action of the story is that a child is born that he calls them tourists. The tourists are convinced it's the reincarnation of Peter Pan. So the animatronic Captain Hook has to deal with Peter Pan in this distant alien setting, you know, in the context of a lost Earth.
That is amazing.
Yeah, and let me tell you the copyright implications of that story are.
Not trivial.
It's in full draft. I'll be revising it shortly. And actually, come to think of it, the next novel I'm writing is, in fact, steampunk. Do you happen to have read my story, Tom Swift and his Electric Telegraph Harpoon?
No, I haven't.
It was in Weird Tales. Mm. There's a continuity I worked on some years ago called Original Destiny, Manifest Sin. And it's a magical history of the Old West. And as we know, the Old West is another setting for a lot of steampunk.
Of course, the Wild West is already sort of a magical setting.
Yes, yes. And I make that very, very explicit. The story, I've had about five or six short stories published out of this work. And it starts out with Lewis and Clark finding the actual gates of Eden in the Missouri Breaks, where the Mormon church sometimes thinks it is.
Right.
And Lewis being killed by the angels that they managed to release and Clark going over the wall and never coming back to Jefferson. And things sort of go downhill from there. And so, it has gigantic steam-powered landwalkers and Zeppelins motoring over the West and an immortal Aaron Burr raining fire down upon the natives. And I wrote about 100 pages of it like 8 years ago and then realized that I wasn't nearly a good enough writer to do justice to this.
Yeah.
And now I probably have enough time to write one more novel before this cancer kills me, and it's going to be that one.
Nice.
And I'm going to be starting on that book sometime in early April, or restarting, I should say, because I'm going to go back to my first 100 pages. There was something really wrong with the manuscript, and I couldn't figure out what it was for a long time. And Maureen McHugh and Howard Waldrop finally told me how to fix it.
Oh, nice.
And the problem is it's multi-POV, kind of like tech thrillers are written.
Yeah.
It's got like 8 different points of view, which means there's no reader identification character, and there's no through line to the story. And I'm going to have 2 narrative voices that are essentially, it's like dueling banjos. And one of them is the voice of original destiny, and the other one's the voice of manifest sin. And they're going to be talking through the vignettes that drive the story.
That's fascinating.
And it's steampunky. And again, it's not so much that I think of it as steampunk, as I realize that it inherently will be seen as steampunk.
Right, yeah. Right.
And, there's plenty of steampunk Westy stuff, and including, interestingly enough, Julian Comstock, which is set, I think, in the 23rd century, that manages to be Old West steampunk. Yeah.
So what did you think of the fact that your novel, Mainspring, was sort of retroactively steampunk?
I was pleasantly surprised.
Hmm.
I absolutely did not have that in mind when I wrote it. To be honest, what I was looking at was just Zelazny's Jack of Shadows, which is what 73.
Oh, that is a great book.
Yeah, and Jack, there's the Clockwork Planet motif shows up in Jack of Shadows, and that was part of the inspiration for me. And I wasn't thinking about the steampunk motif at all at the time. Now, it wasn't that I was unaware of steampunk. That just wasn't where my head was at.
Sure. Well, also that was what year were you working on that?
I think
probably
I
early 2000s.
Wrote it like 2004, 2005.
Yeah, so right about then was. Steampunk was still pretty niche.
It hadn't, it wasn't until like Boneshaker and stuff, and it really just sort of metastasized. Honestly, I sometimes think of Mainspring, it come out about 2 years later, it might have done a lot better commercially.
I like how you just referred to steampunk as a cancer.
I was like, what a telling metaphor.
Yeah.
Hey, if anybody can do cancer metaphors, it's me.
It's true. I just thought that was funny.
Well, it constantly mutates, and
no, it does.
It experiences selection pressure, and it does.
And that's I was talking to Jay about this earlier, but or maybe I was talking to somebody else about this. I don't know. I get confused. But steampunk.
It's only day 2 of the conference, folks.
I know, right? I haven't even been here for 24 hours yet.
This is Thursday. This must be Orlando.
Yeah. So steampunk has really gone through 3 major phase shifts over the course of its lifetime. The very first one was like the beginning of it, essentially, back in like the 1960s, if you want to say that, which I do. I argue.
Pavane, Warlord of the Air, Land of Leviathan.
And we've got.
If you've never read Pavane, you should read Pavane. It's awesome.
I haven't, but I will. Thank you.
It's awesome.
Excellent.
On my list.
Yeah, definitely. But then we also have things, mainstream things like Wild Wild West and even Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and The Great Race and all kinds of stuff happening in the 60s. So we have this big sort of film thing. And then in like the late 60s, 70s, 80s, we start getting a lot of literature, popular literature, that is, that we. At least that we think of today, we've got like Moorcock, Jeter, Blaylock, Powers, etc. We have the coining of the term steampunk, and then just recently, within the last couple of years, we have it. You could kind of think of one of them as when it made the leap to costuming, as being another sort of major phase shift. But I actually look a little bit further than that, as at the point when steampunk has sort of begun crystallizing into a movement that people self-identify as. when it started being costuming at first, it was still sort of a part of the costuming scene, I would argue. But now it's an actual identity for people. People say, I am steampunk.
The way they would say I'm a goth.
Right, exactly.
Which, as Jess Evans said, steampunk is what happens when goths discover bread.
Right. So,
I'll tell you what I like. I find interesting is looking back at work that was contemporary to the era, like Harry Collingwood's Log of the Flying Fish.
Mm-hmm.
which is one of the freakier things I've ever read, quite frankly. You can find it in Project Gutenberg and places like that. And the actual title is about 27 words long, but it's Harry Collingwood, and the short title's Log of the Flying Fish. And it's written about 1881, and it's steampunk in the original Klingon. You know, it's got many of the tropes and elements of what we think of as steampunk, except it was fiction of the time.
Sure.
And there was nothing retroactive or nostalgic or ironic or self-conscious about it.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, and actually the funniest thing in Log of the Flying Fish is the chapter about the evils of labor and how the poor hardworking capitalist is deprived of his profits by the greedy workers. You can pretty much tell where Collingwood's sympathies lie.
Yeah.
And
I think in real life he was a Church of England pastor too at that. So
nice.
You know, I go back and read that, Or The Last American. You know, there's these sort of, you know, we've all sort of read Vernon Wells, but there's a number of other lost classics floating around up there that can really inform you. And you know, those come well before the three iterations you're talking about.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, they're steampunk, or the bones of steampunk. And I don't call them steampunk because they're not nostalgic, except sort of by accident now.
Yeah.
They're nostalgic to us, but they certainly weren't nostalgic to the people who were writing them.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's sort of the big distinction that I make there as well. Whereas for them, it was science fiction.
Yeah.
And the modern analog of that is science fiction, not steampunk. Steampunk is its own phenomenon, which is specifically, in a lot of ways, looking back, but also looking forward, and there's this weird sort of thing going on there.
How do you think steampunk stacks up? Is, you know, we said it wasn't a movement like cyberpunk. Do you think it's more like alternate history, which is sort of a way of writing novels? I mean, alternate history is often bundled with SF, but there's nothing inherently SF-nal about it.
I look at steampunk as a subdivision of alternate history.
Yeah.
Kind of, I say, with an asterisk. The literature is a subdivision of alternate history, I think. But the phenomenon, the movement, the culture, etc., is just its own unique.
Yeah, there aren't alternate history bands and costume movements.
I mean, there actually are. Not for alternate history, but within steampunk there are, So,
but I mean, it's separately from that. But even then, you know, have you read Mike Jay's book, The Heirloom Gang?
No.
A-I-R space L-O-O-M.
No, I haven't.
It got republished under a different title that I can't remember the name of right now, but it's a story about the first, it's narrative nonfiction. It's about the first documented case of technological delusion, the equivalent of the CIA put a chip in my head. And it's about a guy in the very late 18th century in London who tried to assassinate the prime minister and claimed that he was being controlled by vapors issued by a secret loom that Napoleon's France had installed in downtown London. And that the heirloom, this loom wove vapors in the air.
Wow.
And the vapors gave him messages. And it's this whole book about Bedlam and the treatment of the mentally ill, about the politics of very late 18th century England, and about the effect of technology on mental illness and technology on conspiracy theory. And, you know, if you sort of file the serial numbers off and dress it up a little, it'd be a perfectly good steampunk thriller.
Sure.
I mean, and this isn't even fiction.
Yeah.
this is real life.
That's crazy.
Stranger than fiction, as they say.
Yeah, it's a hilarious read, and you really feel sorry for this poor guy. He's lucky they didn't just shoot him and drop him the Thames, I guess, but...
They didn't? That's kind of surprising.
Well, he was kind of well-connected.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, there was all kinds of stuff that was going on back then that we've just sort of lost touch with, you know? Jess Nevins has written a lot about Pulp Fiction of the time, and...
There's a lost world.
Exactly.
Those classic pulps are just lost to us.
Exactly. And, you know, it's part of it is that they were printed on poor quality paper. Part of it is that nobody thought they were worth preserving. You know, and so, but all of these things influenced other writers, you know, Wells, Verne, etc. They would all read these things.
They were pulps.
Right, exactly.
Two-fisted tales of rail adventure. I mean...
So, you know, the ones that we remember today are just, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And, you know,
what does that tell you about the work we do today?
Yeah, I know, right?
It's always a little
You know, 300 years from now, Stephen King will probably be the most studied 20th century writer.
Probably. Probably. Or either that or, God forbid, Stephanie Myers.
Oh, please.
I could handle J.K. Rowling. I could handle that. She's a good writer.
Let's not go any farther than that.
All right.
And more power to her and her fans, you know?
I know.
Give the people what they want.
Sure. But, you know, I mean, apart from that, she's her prose is pretty good, I think. I don't know. You're giving me a blank look.
I'm just not going to go there. It's easy for me to be a snob when I don't mean to be. Because, you know, I feel this way every time I see a bunch of sports fans dressed up in their team colors. I think, y'all look like a gang of idiots. And I think, well, who do I hang out with? You know, I hang out with people dressed up like Klingons. And, you know, really? Are you going to look any more like a gang of idiots dressed like Klingons or dressed like Cleveland Indians? You know?
Yeah.
But we should probably look to wrap things up here. I don't want to keep you guys from dinner, and I don't want to keep myself from the business meeting.
All right.
But let's see, Jay, we've heard a little bit about what you're working on for what your next novel is going to be. Austin, I know that asking you what's coming up next for you is a bit of a complicated question.
Yes, it is. I've been blogging for the past year, writing about steampunk, stuff like that. That's been a lot of fun. Been getting a lot of interesting ideas out there for people to look at. As for what's coming up next, that is a good question. I do so much stuff that I don't rightly know.
Gotcha.
But it'll probably involve some sort of steampunk nonfiction, fiction, props, costumes, something.
Something along those
lines. Yep.
Austin Circa's amorphous blob.
Yes, exactly.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your con.
Thank you,
Kara. I hope that we see you both again here next year. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Karen. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.